and what we're doing to it. And the fact of the matter is, we can't leave it. We can't pull back. And so I think it's incredibly, incredibly revealing. That's why I think you really have to read this stuff. You look at the titles of the articles sometimes in the major publications, but the real content, the real understanding, is to get in there and listen to what these guys are talking about, because what they're saying is, irrespective of what you hear on the evening news or what the administration says is happening or not happening or is going to happen or is not going to happen in relation to the, well, the fact of the matter is that behind the scenes, people are revealing the reality of what's very likely to happen. And I think we need to go to that. You need to really zero in on that and find out what's really going on. We're at 54 minutes after the hour, and I wanted to kind of talk about, just kind of set up something else. A lot of people have asked me, you know, what are you going to talk about on the next program or whatever. I've been walking around for a while with an issue, and especially it's a big one. I'd like to get a little bit into the issue of education, if we can. I thought that I might at least introduce this idea today by suggesting or raising some questions. One of the things that has intrigued me, in fact, one of the things that drew me to the Head-On Radio Network and the whole idea of doing a program like this, besides the fact that I feel that this point of view is so absolutely necessary out there, because if you eliminate it, then we know what we get. I mean, that's what we've been talking about all day, is what we're getting. So it's absolutely vital that this alternative point of view be out there and that people be given the opportunity to raise questions and consider alternatives and discuss things and have conversations and learn from each other and all the things that this administration doesn't seem like it wants to engage in or be a part of at all. But the fact of the matter is, there's more than that, it seems to me, the potential. I know that Bob Kincaid and I have talked about this a lot in emails back and forth, and I think it's very significant. One of the things that intrigues me about Internet radio, about this whole idea that the Head-On Radio Network represents, is I see this as a potentially major, major breakthrough in making education in this country take off in ways that it never took off before.
You're listening to The Horn, the Head-On Radio Network.
This is the Quality News Network. North of Baghdad in Bakuba today, about 50 insurgents struck a U.S. base. After a battle with U.S. soldiers, at least 6 militants were killed. There has been an increase in violence recently in that region, which is a Sunni stronghold. A total of 5 U.S. soldiers were killed in Iraq yesterday. At least 3,405 U.S. troops have been killed since the Iraq war began. In Baghdad today, 2 Iraqi journalists who were working for ABC News were shot to death. More than 100 journalists have been killed since the war began. There is no agreement reached between Democrats and the White House on the Iraq War funding bill. Congressional leaders had offered to allow President Bush to waive a timeline for Iraqi withdrawal. However, the White House rejected that as sending the wrong message. President Bush vetoed the first spending bill because it contained a timetable for U.S. troop withdrawal from Iraq. The White House says it will act quickly to fill the World Bank president post after the current chief, Paul Wolfowitz, announced he will resign at the end of June after controversy over a pay raise he arranged for his girlfriend. Wolfowitz ran the bank for 2 years. French President Nicolas Sarkozy announced his cabinet picks today. His cabinet contains 15 ministers and is about equally split between the sexes. In Mexico, reaction to news of a possible immigration deal, which was struck by a bipartisan group of senators yesterday, is mixed. Many attack the plan's components, such as a measure to limit the number of seasonal workers who are allowed into the United States. In the Gaza Strip, factional fighting continues between Hamas and Fatah gunmen. For the third day in a row, Israeli warplanes struck Hamas targets after southern Israeli sites were hit by Hamas rocket attacks. 8 people were killed by the Israeli strikes. In southern India today, a bomb blast at a historic 17th century mosque killed 13 people overall. After the explosion, Muslims clashed with security forces at several locations. Police fired shots and tear gas to control the rioters. Massachusetts lawmakers may follow Michigan to become the nation's second state to ban discrimination against people because of height or weight. The law would apply in the workplace as well as the real estate market. And in New Jersey, firefighters say the wildfire, which has burned more than 17,000 acres so far, is about 70% contained. You are listening to the Quality News Network, Science and Business next.
Here's good news about your money. Monterey County Bank has won the Bauer Financial 5-Star Superior Rating for financial strength and stability, making it one of the safest banks in Monterey County for your money. It's nice to know your money is in a safe place, but there are even more reasons to bank with Monterey County Bank. They now have 4 convenient locations in Carmel, Monterey, Carmel Valley, and Pacific Grove. And Monterey County Bank is the oldest locally owned bank, now celebrating its 30th anniversary serving you. Here's another important point. Local businesses have come to trust and rely on Monterey County Bank's position as the county's number one SBA small business lender. Safety, convenience, and local people you can trust. That's Monterey County Bank. Stop in at one of our 4 branches and find out why you can bank on us. Monterey County Bank, SBA preferred lender and equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Scientists are trying to find another way to try to coax the humpback whale and her calf, which are still stranded up the Sacramento River about 90 miles from the Pacific Ocean. They may use boats to herd the whales down to the San Francisco Bay and back out to sea. Deep sea explorers in the Atlantic Ocean may have discovered the richest shipwreck treasure in history. 17 tons of silver and gold coins from the colonial era have been raised from the ocean floor. They have a possible value of $500 million. Robust April sales for TurboTax and QuickBooks software increased into its quarterly profits. Microsoft is paying $6 billion for aQuantive, an online advertising firm. It's the software giant. Saudi industrial firm is about to purchase General Electric's plastics division for $11 billion. Microsoft is paying $6 billion for aQuantive, an online advertising firm. It is the software giant's largest acquisition ever. For the 6th straight day in a row, gasoline prices hit a record high. According to AAA, nationwide on average, the price for a gallon of unleaded gasoline is $3.12. Light sweet crude is trading at $64.94 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. And at the close of Wall Street this week, the Dow had another record high close, up 80 points, while the NASDAQ was up 19. There's always more at our website, qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Allie Dramoff.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. If you tuned in yesterday, you heard what I thought was a very interesting panel discussion that took place live at the 59th Annual Conference on World Affairs in Boulder, Colorado, about a month ago, between myself, Patrick Anderson, David Bernkoff, and Mike Frank. You can find out about each of the panelists on my website at radioinsidescoop.com. We're going to continue this discussion today. We're in the question and answer session. And then at the end of the discussion, there'll be about 30 minutes left over. If you missed the beginning, we're going to replay the beginning of the live discussion at the Conference on World Affairs. I hope you enjoy the 2008 presidential stampede.
Welcome, everybody. We're going to get started. My name is Kate Larson. I'll be your moderator. I'm a writer here at the Daily Camera.
A more, especially on the social issues, a more pro-life option, they might gravitate to that individual, and he might actually bottom out. He might have a, you know, these things could go up and down. An independent candidate might start out relatively high, but then, like John Anderson did, might come down below 7-8%. But if you're at anything over 3 or 5%, you're a factor, obviously. So if he kept anywhere near that level, he could tip a couple of states here and there.
I want to. Yeah, Bloomberg. What is this odd media obsession with Bloomberg as a possible independent candidate? Anybody?
He could spend $500 million of his own money.
No, I know that, but is he? Do you think that he's really seriously thinking about this at this stage?
Let's all hope not.
Didn't he say, isn't he the one that said that anybody who leaves an estate behind is silly and foolish? I mean, he has how many billion dollars, and he wants to spend it. So if it's not on charity, it's probably going to be on his own campaigns.
Will it be a race to the center in the general election, or will it be a race to the extreme once the nominations are settled?
Traditionally,
I'm the only one who can talk now. No. I'm the only working microphone.
No, I got a working mic. The tradition is, obviously, you go to the extremes in the primaries and you go to the center in the general. I don't see any reason why this election will be any different.
I agree. It's going to be fighting for the middle.
Well, I might disagree a little bit because I think what happened in 2004, the question is whether they want to replicate it, but this so-called base strategy of 2004 relying on micro-targeting and that sort of thing. And I would, by the way, recommend a really interesting book called Applebee's America. I read it recently, and it goes into great detail about the micro-targeting techniques used by the Bush-Cheney campaign in 2004, Applebee's, and some of the megachurches and how they identify what individuals within their constituencies want, and then how to create what they call navigators to individually reach out to them and get them to come into the fold one way or the other. And that kind of strategy presumes that if you get your people out to vote in very, very high numbers, you can win, and you don't need to go as much toward the middle. And it was also premised on a finding that from the previous three or four elections leading up to 2004, the percentage of true independents, meaning independents who did not lean Republican or lean Democrat, had consistently fallen down to where it was, I think, only 7% in the 2002 election. And that caused Karl Rove and Matthew Dowd to say, maybe we can actually win this by appealing to the Republican-leaning moderates, or independents, I should say, out there. And if there's anything that's changed in the electorate between then and now, you may see them going back to the middle. I think they can make a principal stand on what they stand for as a party and just do, hellaciously work hard to get every single last voter out, many of whom you found many red-type voters, meaning Republican or conservative voters, in blue areas and vice versa. They found that to be the case in Michigan, where a very high proportion of the very important swing voters lived in districts and precincts they never, ever would have targeted. And they did it one by one, and they got thousands and tens of thousands of them to come out and vote. They did it all around the country in all those 17 swing states and surprised a lot of people as a result.
I have a lot of, actually, what you missed is that Mike, under his voice, under the mic, said, "What about Ron Paul?" We both had a good laugh. I think we both like and respect Ron Paul for different reasons. I respect his consistency. I mean, he's a consistent libertarian. I got to give him kudos for that. But no, he has no chance. Okay.
Although you could have a ticket. You could have Ron Paul and Senator Tom Coburn, two gynecologists running for president.
Anyone want to address the
on the Electoral College? On the Electoral College. I also do not support the Electoral College, and I'm proud to say that Maryland, I don't know if you've read this, has already taken the first step. It's already gone through both houses. It's likely to be signed by the governor to pass legislation to be the first state in the country to say, we will give our electoral votes to the popular vote winner as soon as states totaling 270 electoral votes all pass the same legislation. What that means, obviously, is as soon as states totaling 270 votes pass this legislation, it doesn't matter what the other states do. You don't need a constitutional amendment. You don't need all 50 states there. All you need is 270 electoral votes to agree. Then they all vote their votes for the popular vote winner, and goodbye Electoral College. So Maryland's been the first. I applaud Maryland, and I urge you in Colorado and in every state across the country to do the same thing.
I think you're likelier to see Ron Paul as president than you are to see the...
No.
Look, we already...
It won't happen in 2008, but in 10 years? 20 years?
I think he's more likely to be president in 3,000 than. But I think one thing people forget is electoral votes can be cast for whomever the elector wishes. Well, in most states, I think in some states there
depends on the state.
Yeah, but electors do have a little more freedom, and there have been occasions where electors have voted their conscience. Not too many, but some.
Barack Obama.
Which of the current candidates might consider a vice presidential run?
Barack Obama. I know.
It's probably easier
the
to
world is, the world is full of vice
so
presidential candidates who said no.
Right, exactly.
George Bush Sr. being one of them.
I want a Gore-Obama ticket. That's what I'm pushing for. But
I don't think McCain would be a VP. No,
and I don't think Clinton. I don't think Hillary Clinton would take
probably
a VP.
Not Hillary, but I think all the others who were announced would be conceivable. Yeah.
She's asking why everyone refers to Hillary as the front runner.
She's ahead in the polls.
She's got the most money. She's
slightly ahead in money. She's got universal name recognition. She's a force to be reckoned with. She is the front runner. That doesn't mean she's going to win. It just means she's the front runner right now. But I don't know how else you find a front runner besides polls. I mean, she's like at 40-something, and the next one, whether it's Barack Obama or Edwards, is 16 or 17. That's a 20-something point margin. It's too early to have any front runner. But if you're going to have one, it's Hillary Clinton.
Can I ask a question by show of hands? How many people here would support Hillary Clinton?
Yeah. Woo!
How many people would support Obama?
Oh, well, you didn't ask. You're talking about nomination.
How about Al Gore? I mean, so you're voting twice here, right? I didn't mean it that way.
How many of you would support
you
Tom Tancredo?
Two for Tom Tancredo.
You are Tom Tancredo. I knew you were here.
Back there, he's been waiting a while. Okay, the question is about the European process and firmware software.
Last year we did a whole panel on electronic voting, which I think you could probably still buy, and I encourage you to do that. It isn't really what this panel is about, but the Canadian system, they still use paper ballots, and they seem to have fair elections. So there are all kinds of systems.
But seven kind of people in Canada. There are more people in this room than vote in the Canadian Prime Minister's election.
She's asking how we can shift the emphasis back to serious issues and away from how much money everyone is raising.
Well, I agree with you, and I think the big issues, I hope the big issues next year will be getting us out of Iraq, getting national health care, finally having some leadership on global warming, and doing something about the taxes and the deficit. I mean, it seems to me the only thing this administration has done is cut taxes on the rich, and that has to be reversed. And I hope and assume that the Democratic candidate will, speak strongly on all those issues. And I think they're winning issues. And I will be interested to see, what the Republican candidate will say. I mean, maybe it'll be Me Too. Maybe, I don't know. But I don't think any of them, the background of the Republican Party is not such in recent years that they have any obvious leadership in these issues. And I think if we run strong on these issues, we can win.
One thing I would make a point, how do you make money less relevant? I think technology is going to start to do that for us. And the example I'll throw out there is that video that was made sort of on behalf of Obama that was a mimic of the 1984 Apple commercial that hit YouTube, and I think within 36, 48 hours, there were several million people who had actually viewed it. It was getting sent all over the Internet by email, and created a whole wave of free media on behalf of Obama in a way, even though they spent nothing pretty much to do that. That was not an Obama campaign expenditure. Some guy did it out of his basement. And my point is that people who are creative, who have a very unique and appealing way to sell a message, can do this with very, very little overhead, very little expense, and generate the equivalent of millions and millions of dollars of media time on behalf of whatever they believe in. So I think in some ways the days of this, you know, the importance of money are going to start to be numbered. That pure, you may have to hit some threshold to be viable, but once you get above that threshold, there's sort of a law of diminishing returns with respect to campaign dollars raised because of this kind of technology, and God knows what the next breakthrough will be for a campaign situation. If they talk about it being YouTube, it might be something different. But I think it's whatever it's going to be is going to be relatively low-cost ways to communicate with voters in a massive volume.
I sure hope Michael's right, but I think in the meantime, the best way to take money out of politics is public financing of campaigns. It always has been. And if you want to allow, you know, you say, well, okay, private financing is free speech and all that. Okay, here's my answer. What you do is you publicly, if candidate A is willing to spend $100 million to get elected, then candidate B gets has only $20 million, you give him $80 million more. And suddenly there's no incentive for candidate A to raise any money because candidate B gets the same as public financing. Let's put people on an equal level and let them debate and let the American people decide.
Would you limit that only to Republicans and Democrats? Or if the Libertarian Party has a candidate who has a dollar...
Well, what I'd
yeah.
like...
No, I'm serious.
No, that's a fair question. And I think sometimes you have to say, you know, a minimum 2% or 5% or something standard to get that. I also think there's a difference between primaries and general elections, and so there's a whole general discussion there. I do think, though, to get the press off the money issue, the candidates themselves should do a lot of debates and do them until we're blue in the face. And I know virtually no one watches them. I watch them. And I think some of you here watch them. And let's just have debates. Frankly, it's good training for all of them. And we can see the differences among the candidates. And so I like to see more. I love debate, and I want to see as much of it as possible.
Of course.
That's what I meant.
I'm sorry. What was the question? Primary debates, sure, before, after, all the way. Yeah,
absolutely.
And that will happen. I think it always happens.
It will
happen,
and it always does, and we need as much of it as possible.
I think I'd like to know more about Obama, but he seems like someone who has very sincere and serious beliefs. I think John Edwards does. I think most of them do. I can't speak for the Republicans.
I'll speak for the Republicans, I guess. I mean, Giuliani and the social issues, I think, is the most stark illustration of that. Tancredo and immigration, not that he's a viable candidate, but that does split the party quite dramatically. McCain, over the years, has done an awful lot of sort of bipartisan legislating that when you think about how it would be characterized in, you know, ads or in debates would probably hurt him. It's not just campaign finance reform, but it's various health care initiatives, even immigration. You know, he's on a global warming bill. There's a lot of things he's done that you can imagine in a primary context would not suit, you know, the free market, limited government mode. And as for the others, I mean, Romney is probably close fit, but he's really getting hammered for that Massachusetts healthcare reform, which, just in full disclosure, some experts at Heritage were very instrumental in helping design, and we're doing the same kind of thing around the country in various states now. And that final product was a little bit different than what we were helping, urging upon them at the time. But that's now turned against him a little bit because it's viewed as a mandate and as sort of a version of socialized medicine, which it really isn't.
I just, you know, it's interesting because several people, maybe everyone has mentioned this name as the kind of core candidate in terms of of values, and yet he doesn't have much of a chance, it would seem. When I look at who has been elected in the past, what kinds of people, where they've come from politically, where they've come from in terms of experience, it is really hard to find someone geographically, where they come from geographically, it's hard to find someone who fits the central casting mode better than Bill Richardson. I mean, this is a guy with international negotiating experience with the North Koreans, for crying out loud. A guy who was energy secretary. I mean, what issue is bigger? He's a successful governor who's governed from a bipartisan area in a western state, which is key to the Democratic strategy. He's Hispanic. I mean, you look at him, and then you go, now, is he really running? I mean, because he's not the most charismatic, although he's not bad, but he's raised almost no money. He's nowhere in the polls.
I was just going to say, he's an extremely qualified candidate. I'm sure he'd be a great president. If only he had a personality, he'd be, you know, but he doesn't have much of one.
He's asking about the likelihood of illegal immigration becoming a core issue, given the fact that the Dems seem more aligned with the president right now on the issue.
I see it as pretty far down the list, maybe fifth or sixth. I think there are four or five other issues that are, to the nation as a whole, are more urgent. But obviously some people feel strongly about it. Some regions of the country feel strongly about it. I think it's a very tough issue. I think it's hard to – most issues I can come down pretty quickly on, but I think it's a very tough issue.
I think it's a little higher than that, actually, on the Republican side. And my guess is that the kind of voters who are most likely to get involved in primary politics and volunteer and vote are the ones who tend to be most worked up over immigration as an issue. So I think it may be disproportionately important in the Republican primaries. And if you go state by state, obviously in a state like South Carolina, where there's a lot of kind of still isolationist sentiment over textile mills shutting down and trade issues being a threat to the future jobs and so on. I think a state like that, that primary electorate just might, that might be a very important issue. But, you know, like David was saying, so many states now have moved their primaries forward, including like New Jersey and California, I think is early part of February. Immigration will take on a whole different coloration in those kind of primaries.
Go ahead. Who on the Republican side of the major candidates is going to take the Tom Tancredo position? I mean, if they all agree with the Democrats essentially and the president essentially on immigration, it sort of dampens it as an issue because there's nobody saying, hey, don't vote for those other guys. They're wrong on this.
Where's Pat Buchanan when you need him?
Right. Well, it's if you look at Giuliani, I mean, McCain is obviously going to be out with the president on that issue. Giuliani and Romney are look at it a little bit more from the lines of security, and I think they'll be more willing to put out a platform relating to, you know, a lot of border security strengthening provisions that they'd want. And, you know, and there's issues like Newt starting to talk about that could gain currency in a Republican primary environment of kind of reverting some of the bilingual programs into English immersion type programs. And that has like an 80% approval rating in all the polls. And that's the kind of thing that could split a couple of candidates if they don't get on the right side of it.
In my view, illegal immigration is something both parties will run far away from. And let me tell you why. It's the weird issue that splits all of us down the middle. Democrats are torn and Republicans are torn. Democrats are torn between union supporters, which is a big part of our constituency, and labor, and they're undercutting our wages. Keep them out. And Latinos and diversity, and it's all part of multicultural America, let them in. That's our problem. Republicans are split between the business class that wants really, really cheap labor to exploit, and the Republicans that say, we hate multicultural diversity, keep this country speaking English only and ever. So both sides are split and riven, and they're both going to hide from the problem.
Alabama once had a great governor, a great populist governor named Big Jim Folsom, And they would say, Big Jim, where do you stand on the race issue? And he'd say, I'm all right on that one, boy. Next question.
Sir. He's asking if the Democratic candidates are smart enough to run a 50-state campaign.
I certainly hope so, or you know, maybe a 45, 46-state campaign. But I think you know, if you've got a good message, you should get out there and deliver it as widely as possible. There aren't too many states you really have to write off.
We need 50-state campaigns, obviously, for Congress, which is very important, House and Senate. State legislatures are very important, particularly when this gerrymandering is coming around in 2010, which means that the elections of 2008 are very important. But let's face it, with this cockamamie electoral vote system we have that I'd like to abolish, in the presidential race, it doesn't make sense in the presidential race to run a 50-state campaign except when you're helping lower down tickets. That's a structural flaw in our system, one I'd like to fix. But you can't blame the presidential campaigns for, you know, like in 2004, spending trillions of dollars, whatever, in Ohio and totally ignoring Massachusetts and Texas. So it's a problem with our system. But I can't blame them for at the presidential level not running a 50-state battle.
Why have they avoided the Iraq factor on the panel?
Probably because only John McCain is supporting the president's position, and we've said that he's going to lose because of it. The rest of the Republicans are being very cagey and very careful. I don't know another one. Maybe you can help me out, Mike. But other than John McCain, is there any Republican that supports the president's position on Iraq?
Yeah, I think I don't think anyone's just overtly distanced themselves. You know, they haven't cut the cord yet, but they have, I think, said things in sort of nuanced ways to create a little bit of daylight, and it's
the Democrats pretty much are all against it, and the Republicans, with the exception of John McCain, are very scared to talk about it. So
I do wonder whether, if the war in Iraq is roughly where it is today, in November of 2008, it's hard for me to see how any Republican can win a national
unless
election.
They distance themselves from the president,
but
which they might
at that
do.
Point, I think even then it's probably too late. If we're at the same point we're at now, and that's I don't know whether we'll be there or not, and we're still a year and a half away from that. It's hard for me to believe that even this administration would keep doing the same thing till election day. But
that's not hard for
will.
Me to believe. But
take one last question. The question is if folks are noticing that Obama seems to be the only candidate capturing the interest of the lethargic younger generation.
I think that's totally true. I think he's an exciting candidate. He's different. He suggests a break with the past, which many of us think we need. I think what we don't know yet is how broad and deep that excitement will be. Will it be, I mean, a lot of us worked very hard for George McGovern, but he was not able to get to 50%. On the other hand, John Kennedy raised a lot of enthusiasm, and it was enough to elect him. And I just don't think we know yet how far his appeal will reach. But there's no question it's there, and I think it's legitimate. And I want to know more about him.
On the Republican side, I think Giuliani has connected with a lot of younger voters. Just what I've noticed. It's more anecdotal than it is based on any kind of polling data.
And we're going to go in alphabetical order here. Our first, I forgot to say, this is the 12:30 panel. You're in UMC 235, and this is the Presidential Stampede. Our first guest is Pat Anderson. He's in D.C. He's a writer, and he's... Our first guest is Pat Anderson. Can you hear me now? He's a writer. He lives in D.C., and he spent time in the 60s writing for the Kennedy and Johnson administration, and now, and also the Clinton administration, and he does book reviews now for the Washington Post. Our next guest is, I think, our only representative outside the Beltway, David Bernkoff.
Don't insult your audience.
He runs a PR firm in Georgia and spent over 20 years at CNN producing political coverage. The man to my left I don't think needs a whole lot of introduction. He's kind of a star here at CWA. This is Michael Frank. He's with the Heritage Foundation and spends a lot of time in D.C. And to our left is Mark Levine, who has a radio show in D.C. called The Inside Scoop. And he's also well-known at CWA, I would say. So we're going to start with Mr. Anderson.
Thank you for coming out. Tell me if this isn't coming through or isn't loud enough. As the introduction suggested, I'm... As the introduction suggested, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm a partisan. I'm a Democrat. I worked for the McGovern campaign in 72 and the Carter campaign in 76 and Al Gore in 88 and so forth. And as a Democrat, I think it's extremely important that we win this election next year. As a Democrat, I think it's very important that we win this upcoming election. There's an applause line. And I think we should win it. I mean, all the indications, what happened in last year's elections, the polls, the situation in Washington suggests it should be a very good year if we don't blow it, which we have done in the past. I think we have an embarrassment of riches. There are at least half a dozen candidates out there who I would be happy to see as president. And as I look at them, when I talk to you today, it's part of it is what I think may happen, and part of it is what I hope will happen, because I'm looking for the candidate who's most likely to win. To me, that's the most important criteria. And granting that it's an extremely unpredictable process, anybody who's followed primaries and people seeking the nomination, that incredible things happen. People make stupid mistakes. Nobody knows what's going to happen, but I will try to suggest a little bit of what I think might happen. I'm going to start with Hillary Clinton, who is clearly the front runner among the Democrats at this point. I had the opportunity to hear her speak a number of times during the Clinton administration. She is obviously extremely intelligent, extremely articulate, extremely well informed. She works very hard. As a senator, she's gone in and done a good job. She's apparently made a lot of friends there that people you might not think would have been her allies. She's very impressive. As a candidate, she has access to a great deal of money. She has, as her de facto campaign manager, the smartest mind in Democratic or American politics right now, I would say. Obviously, that's her husband, who's also great at raising money and drawing crowds, and he will be very helpful to her. So I think if you look at it right now, you have to say she's the front runner. On the other hand, there is a downside to her situation as I see it. She has a lot of baggage. Some of it's not fair, some of it's sexism, but it is there. I think the Republicans have been beating up on her for 15 years now. Some of that sticks. It raises doubts. I'm not convinced she's a great candidate. She's a great senator. She might make a great president. I'm not convinced she's a great candidate. If you go back to 92, that's a long time ago, but she said a couple of things during the campaign that were really not very smart. Do you remember I could have stayed home and made cookies? Well, that offended a lot of women who stay home and make cookies, and it was not necessary. She said, I could have been like Tammy Wynette and stood by my man. Well, a lot of people like Tammy Wynette. You know, that was not necessary. I think she kind of rolls her eyes in funny ways, I think she's got a lot of baggage, although, as I say, a lot of it's not fair. I think that my guess is, and I could be wrong, my guess is that she may, I think it's going to be tougher than people thought for her to get the nomination. I think she may fade. She may not get the nomination. And one reason is that another candidate has come along who has shown he can match her in fundraising and then perhaps an enthusiasm among his supporters, and that, of course, is Barack Obama. So, obviously, you can't rule her out, and I'd be happy to support her if she gets it, but I'm not sure she will get it. I think if I could pick the next president, I would probably pick Barack Obama. Unfortunately, I can't pick the next president. I think, you know, we white guys have been screwing things up for 200 years. Let's give a black guy a chance to screw things up. Seriously, I think we need to know a lot more about him, but he's awfully attractive. I think he comes from places that most of the conventional candidates don't come from. People talk about, oh, does he have enough experience? Well, I'm not sure experience is what it's about. I mean, who are the most experienced people in Washington right now? That's probably Cheney and Rumsfeld. You know, where have they gotten this? You know, I think there's also concern about his race. There's a lot of racism in this country. It may be somewhat more muted than it was some years ago, but it's there. Maybe most of it's in states that he wouldn't carry, that a Democrat's not going to carry anyway, but still, there'll be polls, there'll be more indications, more information than what we have now on how he emerges as a national candidate. I also think we have to find out, he's running as kind of a nice guy, and I'm sure he is a nice guy. We need to know more about how tough he is. Can he handle the pressures of what will be a very tough, dirty campaign? Maybe he can. I hope he can. But I think we don't know yet. If you, going past Clinton and Obama, then you, it seems to me there are at least three possible, we return to the white male candidates. I think Richardson is a very well qualified man who might make a very good president, but I don't think hasn't shown that he can compete in the money raising process. I think John Edwards is, he's fine with me. A lot of people seem to be suspicious of him. They say he's too slick. They say he's too pretty. They say we don't trust him. I think to me he's a man who grew up poor, worked hard, made a lot of money as a lawyer, has a wonderful wife, obviously, and is sincere in his populism. I think he wants to do things for the poor and do things for the American people that need to be done. So he's fine with me. And he conceivably, if the first two cancel each other out or get in a deadlock, he certainly could emerge. I want to mention one other possibility who to me is a dark horse but might move up, and that, of course, is Al Gore. Al Gore is, I think, some of us think he won in 2000, and I think he could more easily win this time. It should be a good year. His positions on global warming suggest that he could provide the leadership that a lot of people think we need on that. He's very smart. I think he would run a tough campaign. So I would keep my eye on Al as a possible dark horse in this campaign. I just want to say more briefly about how I see the Republicans, and I think their situation is even more confused than ours. I think McCain, until recently, was considered the front runner. I would be happy to see him as the candidate because I think he'd be the easiest one to beat. I think his support of the war is certainly quixotic. It's running against the tide of public opinion. I don't think it's going to help him any. He's a good man, but I think he's going to fade. I think he's already fading. You have Giuliani. We'll probably get into this in more detail, but obviously Giuliani has an awful lot of baggage. And I think it will probably sink him before too long. I think Romney, in many ways, might be their strongest candidate. He's attractive. He's smart. He's got a very respectable home life, as far as anyone can see, which sets him apart from a number of people. His problem, of course, is that he's as a governor of Massachusetts, he supported a bunch of positions, liberal positions, that now he's having to renounce. And even having done that and somewhat compromised himself, there's the question of whether the conservatives would really accept him, or if he was the nominee, would it split the party? Might there be a right-wing candidate? I don't know. But I think he might well be their strongest candidate. And finally, I think the dark horse that I have my eye on for the Republicans would be Fred Thompson, former Senator Fred Thompson, who you know from Law and Order. He's a pretty conservative guy. He's a big, tough-looking guy. He's got a certain gravitas to him. I think I can see how he might emerge. I can see how he might be a good candidate for them. So I think it's highly uncertain. It's going to be a fascinating year, year and a half. Thank you.
Just to tell you how far outside the Beltway I am, I actually have had as my congressman, my personal congressman in my district, both Newt Gingrich and Bob Barr. So that tells you what kind of neighborhood I live in. You know, calling this a stampede is really accurate. I know a lot of people have tried to compare it and said, back to 1952, and said, "This is, you know, that was the last time we had anything this wide open." But I think that analysis is faulty, because in 1952 it wasn't really wide open. Once Eisenhower decided, you know, he was going to run as a Republican, there really wasn't much question that he was going to win that nomination. And people do forget that there was a vice president on the Democratic side who, for about 15 seconds, thought he could be president. A guy named Albin Barkley, I think, and he ultimately lost the nomination to Stevenson. So you really have to go back to 1928 before you find this kind of an open stampede of candidates. And I'll try to be more observational than partisan here, and I'll try to be a little outside the Beltway. And I've gone down my list of all the candidates, and my conclusion is that there's not one of them who can win the presidency. They all have such severe faults. And so I'm going to go down and list the faults that I, as a journalist, would have honed in on in my coverage. I agree with much of what you said on the Republican side and on the Democratic side. I think John McCain made a terrible error, forgot that the reason the press loved him the first time around is that he was the underdog, and he was the guy who let the press hang out in the bus with him and drink a scotch. And you can't do that now as the front runner. You can't afford to do that. And so all of a sudden, Maureen Dowd is writing columns about whatever happened to the old John McCain. Plus, he is a lot older now, and I think that is showing in some of his campaign appearances. So I agree that he can't win. All right. Rudy Giuliani, strong candidate, has maybe the strongest positive image amongst all the candidates. I don't think that a Republican can win the primaries going down to South Carolina saying you favor public funding for abortions. I just don't think that's possible. There are those who tell me I'm crazy, so he can't win. All right, Romney, nobody knows him. He has the classic problem that journalists love to see. He has no strong image. He is already creating an image in a vacuum of a guy who will say anything to win elections, who will say anything to any group, forgetting that now everything you say is instantly on YouTube. So he's a lifelong hunter who hunted rabbits twice, who I hunted more than two times, but I'm not going to tell you how many times I hunted. And I joined the NRA last week, but I really am a hunter my whole life. And I think that is a really insignificant detail, except that in the vacuum, it becomes a narrative the way, you know, Dan Quayle is the really stupid guy became a narrative. And no matter how many positive David Broder columns there were, he couldn't change that narrative. It is also a narrative, I think, that Hillary has to face. Her narrative is that she's nasty, rotten, evil Hillary, and that's hard for her to beat, so she can't win. I don't think, you know, her negatives are so high in every poll you see, she can never win an election. Okay, she can't win. Romney can't win. Tom Tancredo, you guys, if anybody knows, wait. Are you in the room, Congressman Tancredo? You might be here. I'm sorry, I don't. Okay, I will remember for the rest of my life the reaction of his own fellow Coloradans to his name. Okay, so we all agree he can't win. Duncan Hunter, any of you heard of Duncan Hunter? He likes the publicity. He obviously can't win. Jim Gilmore, he used to be a governor of Virginia. Oh, my gosh, he can't win. Who knows him? My old congressman, Newt Gingrich. He's cleared the decks. He's talked about his, well, one of his affairs. We all know his negatives are higher than Hillary's. He can't win. Fred Thompson, a great possible candidate, except everybody who's ever spent 5 minutes around him knows he doesn't have the, he doesn't want to work hard enough to win, and he, you know, he's got to be talked into it, and it's late. I don't know, maybe he can win. I don't know, but I don't think he can win. A TV guy, I don't know, ready for another actor. Gosh, who have I left out? Edwards, pretty boy, rich lawyer. He can't win. Obama, he can't win. How, he's got no experience. We don't know anything about him. His, you know, even as a senator, he can't even point to great accomplishments in his short time in the Senate. Plus, you know, the racial issue, my gosh, in this country, he can't win. So I'm looking forward to hearing somebody convince me on this panel or in this audience that there is somebody who can win the presidency. And the real downside here is that when we get to 2008 and there is no president elected, you think George Bush is walking out of that White House voluntarily? Ain't gonna happen.
There's a panel later on today, I think the title is What Women Really Want. And unfortunately, I'm not on that panel, I'm on this one, so I thought maybe I could just go through what the GOP really wants in a presidential candidate and then talk about the Democrats a little. And then talk a little bit about the electorate, where I think they would be. Number one, I think if you look at, you know, David's right, you talk to senior folks in Washington who have been Republicans their whole lives, they were all having these quiet, you know, sessions where they're trying to figure out who among all these people do we really like, you know, who fits the profile that we've created over the years for what a Republican presidential nominee should be like. And they were all scratching their heads. They all kind of run down the list, you know, somewhat differently maybe than David, but close. And they come to very much the same conclusions that, you know, there's just no one out there who's, and this is character trait number one, another Reagan. I mean, they're looking for someone who has leadership skills and charisma, could be persuasive, has a vision that they would agree with, and takes, you know, American interests very, very seriously and wants to project them and be a strong leader. That's, I think, where they are, maintaining prosperity and all that sort of thing. And they go through the list and they hear nice things from these various candidates, but they always find that there's some flaw there. And I think they're in a mindset where they're looking at how empty the glass is rather than how full the glass is. So if the glass is partially empty, they exaggerate that in their minds, and that becomes part of the problem for them. There are some splits that are fairly well known, I think, among on the right of center side of the spectrum, mostly Republican, that are worth mentioning. And that could play, those issues could play, I think, serious roles in a nomination fight. Immigration is probably at the front of that. Boy, is that a divisive issue. You have a lot of Republicans are very free market, very, like, think of the Wall Street Journal editorial page. They're very friendly toward the notion of immigration and the economic importance of bringing a steady flow of immigrants into this country. And they don't like the sound of the folks out there, you know, maybe Tom Tancredo is one of the leading examples of that, who have take the opposite point of view and see immigration as a threat, not only as a security threat, but as a threat, I think, to the cultural fabric of the country. And that splits the Republicans right, not just down the middle, but it splits it in almost any way you decide to slice the GOP, you know, orb, if you would. Is it going to be a split there, whether it's libertarian versus, you know, isolationist, or there's some cultural concerns in there. There's some fiscal concerns in there as well. And then national security issues come in, I think. And that spills over a little bit into trade policy. And there's over the years I've noticed in getting to know incoming classes of Republican House members especially, ever so slightly there seems to be an increase in the number of incoming Republican congressmen who are more protectionist or at least skeptical about the idea of free trade. And that's something I think that's showing up in primaries and electorates and polls and that sort of thing. And social issues, obviously, David did a good job of laying that one out there. Classic, you know, is Giuliani's recent observation that not only is abortion a constitutional right, in his opinion, but it should be funded. And that's something I think that's going to get replayed over and over and over again. But I think the way I would look at least at some of these issues is where will the electorate ultimately rank these issues? And I would also suggest that what I'm picking up is if you think of the Republican side of the ledger as a big family holiday dinner with multiple generations present, sitting around carving up the turkey and everything, I think there's a growing split between the elder statesmen in the party and those who are younger and coming up. You know, they do this convention every year called CPAC, which you can see it on C-SPAN and so on. It gets about 3,000 or 4,000 folks in, and a lot of them are very young and college Republican types, and they're much more receptive to John McCain than any of the kind of the, you know, blue-haired, gray-haired senior statesmen who run the various conservative organizations. And the same is very true of Giuliani. Giuliani is a rock star to a lot of younger Republicans out there. And what I'm getting at here, I think, is going on is when you get outside the Beltway and get outside the kind of the establishment conservative movement, the value structure may be a little bit different. I think that a lot of people who might be voting in Republican primaries are going to be looking at maybe security issues as first and foremost, and leadership of America in the world issues first and foremost, and maintaining prosperity first and foremost, and then some of these social issues that they might disagree on. They may decide, well, you know, it doesn't mean a whole hell of a lot if we're going to get attacked again. And we think this guy over here might be the best person to prevent the next attack. Therefore, I'm going to, you know, sublimate my, you know, abortion view to my priority issue, which would be, say, national security. And I think there's some of that going on, which may explain why Giuliani continues to do quite well. And we'll see. That may change in the next few weeks based upon what he said last week. Another thing I'll just mention briefly is, you know, there was a recent poll done by Pew, the Pew Polling Organization, that they do it every couple of years, and it's sort of a broad assessment of the value structure of Americans. And they ask a lot of these questions over and over so you can do a nice trending analysis. And they found that I think the Democrats now have something like a 50-33 party ID advantage, where more recently, like 4 years ago, was pretty much even. And a lot of folks wrote columns about that and thought that was important. And I think there was clearly a shift, and the shift seemed to be, they found a couple things. One is that the Democrats did not go up at all in favorability, approval, you know, those kinds of things. Republicans just plummeted. And that's where the big shift took place, especially among the independent-minded voter. Their approval rating for the Republican Party dropped something like, I forget if it was like 20-some-odd points, but stayed the same for Democrats. So instead of the Republicans having a slight advantage among independents, they had an enormous disadvantage in 2006. And so a lot of people have focused on the important role of the independent voter coming up. And I took a look at that poll, kept kind of going through it in more detail, and I was struck also by, among independent voters, that they're not a whole lot, they haven't changed their ideology. They've just decided they went sour on the Republicans. And a couple of numbers that just bear this in mind when you hear people talk about these independent voters. 60% say that when the government runs something, it is inefficient and wasteful. And 60% say the government does more harm than good. 70% say the strength of America is mostly based on the success of business. By 48-40 margin, they said they would support a smaller government and fewer services to a bigger one with more services. And that actually may understate some of that. There was a poll done right after the election of only people who actually voted. And they found that independents in that poll, by a 68-20 margin, wanted the smaller, leaner government. And, you know, on the Republican side, too, just bear in mind, there were some polls done right on Election Day, pretty much, focusing on, I think it was 12 or 15 competitive House seats, the ones that were, you know, most at play, and I think as it turns out, four or five of them went from Republican control, and they were all Republican control seats, went from Republican to Democratic, and the rest were, you know, within two of them had recounts, and all of them were very, very tight. And they asked a lot of questions about which party is better able to do this, to do that. And it was striking to me that when they asked questions like which party is the party of bigger government, in these Republican districts, they were picking the Republican Party by 20-some-odd points. Which party is the party of lower taxes? And Democrats were ahead by, 15 or 20 points. And then which party is more likely to keep deficits down? And Democrats had a 20-some-odd point advantage. And then they said, which party is better able to win the war in Iraq? And the Republicans actually had a small 4 or 5 point advantage. So when you look at, in some of those races, if there was turning sour point of view somewhere, I think it might have been that on the Republican-minded electorate really turned against their own candidates because they thought they'd violated their core convictions about what government should be doing and how much of it. I'll stop there, but bear that in mind. I think the Iraq war for a lot of these Republican candidates was a surmountable obstacle, but when they gave away their brand,
this is the Quality News Network. There has been no agreement reached between Democrats and the White House on the Iraq War funding bill. Congressional leaders had offered to allow President Bush to waive a timeline for Iraqi withdrawal. However, the White House rejected that as sending the wrong message. President Bush vetoed the first spending bill because it contained a timeline for U.S. troop withdrawal from Iraq. North of Baghdad in Bakuba today, about 50 insurgents struck a U.S. base. After a battle with U.S. soldiers, at least 6 militants were killed. There has been an increase in violence recently in that region, which is a Sunni stronghold. A total of 5 U.S. soldiers were killed in Iraq yesterday. At least 3,405 U.S. troops have been killed since the Iraq war began. In Baghdad today, 2 Iraqi journalists who were working for ABC News were shot to death. More than 100 journalists have been killed since the war started. The White House says it will act quickly to fill the World Bank president post after the current chief, Paul Wolfowitz, announced he will resign at the end of June after controversy over a pay raise he arranged for his girlfriend. Wolfowitz ran the bank for 2 years. French President Nicolas Sarkozy announced his cabinet picks today. His cabinet contains 15 ministers and it is about equally split between the sexes. In the Gaza Strip, factional fighting continues between Hamas and Fatah gunmen. For the 3rd day in a row, Israeli warplanes struck Hamas targets after southern Israeli sites were hit by Hamas rocket attacks. 8 people were killed by the Israeli strikes. In southern India today, a bomb blast at a historic 17th-century mosque killed 13 people overall. After the explosion, Muslims clashed with security forces at several locations. Police fired shots and tear gas to control the rioters. In Mexico, reaction to the news of a possible immigration deal, which was struck by a bipartisan group of senators yesterday, has been mixed. Many attack the plan's components.